been a week since Taylor Swift's new music video was released. It's for a song called You Need to Calm Down. The singer is referring to haters in general, and specifically anti-gay activists. You are somebody that I don't know, but you're taking shots at me like it's Patron, and I'm just like, damn, it's 7 a.m. The video is colorful and dramatic. There's a camper van catching fire in the middle of the desert, and it's full of cameos from A-list LGBT celebrities. Ellen DeGeneres gets a tattoo. Adam Rippon shows up as a snow cone vendor. Laverne Cox waters her lawn in a pink sequined gown, and the Fab Five are having a lot of fun at a pool party. It's been a very talked about piece of media, and we'll hear a little bit about why, but what we want to talk about first and foremost is the fact that a Kansas City Art Institute grad led the art department on this production. I'm Gina Kaufman, this is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're getting the inside scoop from Megan Mantia, speaking with us now from LA. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. It's so good to hear from you. Your career has really taken off since you moved to California.
Yes, I mean, I also am back in Kansas City all the time producing, and I still love to work there more than anything. Cody Critchlow and I are back all the time doing projects there as well. And Leon Reeves also worked on this video, and she's
also an Art Institute grad.
Exactly.
Do I remember right that the two of you were involved in starting Raw Booty?
Yeah, Leon was one of the founding members of Raw Booty. Exactly.
So that was like the faux cheerleading squad at KCAI.
Yes, we were the radical cheerleaders of Kansas City, and she started it. I was in it the longest.
So. The longest?
Yeah.
Longest standing squad member.
10 years, I believe, for me.
Well, as I mentioned, there is a lot of buzz around this Taylor Swift video, and a lot of that comes down to politics around being an ally. That's been a mixed bag, which in some ways is to be expected. But I haven't read one negative word about the look of the video. It's been really well received in that respect.
Yeah, we were very excited. The last video they did for me, not the same team. I'm not sure who did the last one, but it was a lot more effects heavy. And for this one, they wanted things to be more practical. So which practical means is that everything is in person, done actually in real life, which the fire you see is real.
Yeah, I want to back up there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The fire you see. So like... The idea that it is more practical to actually set a camper on fire.
Well, yeah. So the word practical, it's a kind of an in-industry term where it just means that it's done actually instead of in effects or in post.
Oh, okay. So, not like, you know, it's, yeah. It's the logical thing to do is not
exactly.
What you mean.
No, yeah. It's just a term in production where it means if you see, like if a light source is practical, it means the lamp is actually on in the room versus a fake lighting source from the electricians.
Okay, we're going to get back to the fire, but just on a very basic level, what does an art department for a music video do? I mean, what do we mean when we say you directed an art department on this video?
Well, so basically, my title was the art department coordinator. And so in many ways, it's almost like being the producer of the department. I kind of manage everyone and make sure that everybody is hired and shows up, and I help do a lot of the paperwork. And if anything goes wrong, I have to deal with it, or if there's last minute additions or requests, I help them research that and get that handled. Like when Ellen was going to be having Taylor on the show and they needed to shoot her part on the WB lot, I was asked to coordinate a trailer to be delivered to her last minute. And so within a very small amount of time, we coordinated getting that trailer delivered there. And so that's one example of something that we have to do on the fly. Above me is an art director, and above him is the production designer. And so she works with the director of the entire video to kind of bring the concept to life visually. And then we as a department carry out everything visual that you see, which is all of the sets, all the set dressing, and all of the props.
Which is a lot. I would say that in this video, every single costume could be considered its own work of art requiring some level of production. And then when you consider, by my count, and I could be wrong, there are 22 celebrities in addition to Taylor Swift in this video. Taylor Swift wears multiple costumes. There are multiple settings. Coordinating all of that and making sure that it has a consistent, like, aesthetic, that is actually like quite a feat.
It was a major undertaking. And our department doesn't deal with any of the costumes because that is its own. Like, everybody has a department and, you know, lighting is a whole department. There's a lot that every department has to deal with. But yes, we had to make all of those different sets, most of which get built right beforehand and then torn down immediately afterwards. So it's a frenzy. And we had a group of like 36 people making this a reality. So we did have a couple prep days. We were on location painting in the rain and making sure everything stayed as nice as possible before the actual shoot.
But did you kind of want to cry when you had to tear it down? I'd be yes. Like, no, I'm living here now. I'm never going away.
It is really hard to have to do that. And you know, her team has a lot of secrecy around it. We actually repainted a lot of things just to make sure that nobody could use it in the same way again. Certain things, you know, the location always wants things to go back to the way they were so that when people rent it in the future, it's ready to go. So we deal with all of that. Any of the resetting, you know, liaising with the space that we use every time we come into any space, that often becomes our problem. So,
and the whole, like, nobody can ever find the debris, basically, like, that is about secrecy and not wanting to preempt the look before it's released? Or is that about not wanting people who are like off brand to go around using her stuff?
It's both, really. I mean, I don't want to speak for their team, but I think in this case, well, in many cases, I think people want to ensure that the look that they've created is unique to them. And also, a lot of times it's just required that you reset things anyway. So
what does the making of something as ambitious as this look like from behind the scenes? We talked a little bit about the fire, and you mentioned that it's real. I mean, when the video starts, Taylor Swift is waking up in this kind of kitschy, very pastel camper van. She's checking her phone, seeing a bunch of hate being thrown around online. Finally, she tosses her phone to the side and sets the camper on fire and walks off into the desert with flames climbing higher and higher behind her. What's going on behind the scenes before you shoot that?
Well, first of all, there's a very big safety meeting. There's usually the AD, which is the assistant director, gathers everyone. We usually start the day with a safety meeting, but we'll do another one right before fire or weapons or anything of that nature. Then there's always an effects team that's brought in that are professionals that deal with fake firearms, blanks, or real fire, and sometimes fog machine. They'll handle that as well. But sometimes on a smaller scale, the art department is in charge of fog if it's not too crazy. So for this one, we were doing both. Like, we were handling fog a little bit. And then we also had a whole effects team of 7 people in addition to our 36 people that were on site at that time dealing with just that. And so they are trained to deal with everything. They have fire extinguishers at every point. They're literally right behind that trailer, making sure that the flame bars are lit and then extinguished immediately afterward. They make sure that Taylor is a certain distance from the trailer when we start. We start the fire, yeah. So she was allowed to be near it. I also just recently worked on a Tyler, the Creator video, and we also did real fire for that one. If anyone has seen Earthquake, I think the same effects team. There were similar producers on each project, and so I think the same fire people came and did both those fires.
Okay, but back to this fire scene. I only know this because I kind of timed out how long it would take me to talk over the music earlier, but I happen to be aware of exactly how long of a scene we're talking about because of that. We're talking about less than 40 seconds.
Yeah.
The proportion of effort into and seconds resulting from it is insane.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. People don't realize how much work goes into music videos. What's cool is that there's actually, I mean, it's not as much money as, say, in the 90s, but there's definitely money going into, I mean, a lot of people are demanding very original content and wanting to do something really spectacular visually because it gets them a lot of attention online and it can enhance a song greatly. So, you know, again, it's not always a ton of money, but a lot of times the want is there to create something visually spectacular, even though the, you know, tradition of MTV has kind of come to pass in the traditional sense. So it's really exciting because there's a lot of music videos going on and a lot of directors that are bringing really cool creative treatments to the table. So it's exciting to work right now, even though it's not quite like the golden age, but there's so much work that goes into it. I can't even say it enough. I don't even know how else to say it. But yeah, for just seconds of time, we'll have so, I couldn't even tell you who was all standing on set at that exact moment of the fire. Like hundreds, probably at least 150, maybe 200 people just for those 40 seconds. Plus we built the pool, you know, we had to set all of those fake shrubberies and all of the flowers and all those little details, so.
Okay, there is also a scene that I want to ask you about that seems to be an homage to Edward Scissorhands, mm-hmm. with these unnaturally green, like astroturfy lawns perfectly squared off by a picket fence. Laverne Cox steps out with a watering can, and her neighbor, who is dressed in pink, gives her this super judgmental look before, like, fake fainting with the hand on the forehead.
And the scarf, yeah.
Yes. Talk to me about this.
That's my friend Chester Lockhart. He's a really amazing musician and pop star, Korean pop star in L.A. And is also about to be in a show, and the name escapes me, but he's an actor and does a million things. But so he's also a very exciting person. And the whole neighborhood, our designer's name is Brittany Porter. She's this like young, inventive, incredible production designer. And her art director, Zachary Friedman, are like this stunning team that do incredible design work. And they came up with this, you know, not Brittany came up with this great concept to kind of pay homage to Edward Scissorhands, which is one of my most favorite films of all time and big influence on me as a child.
What do you like about it?
Well, I mean, I love the poppy colors, like literally everything you see in this video. I was so excited because those overhead shots of the neighborhood, creating a fake neighborhood, showing the blandness of suburbia, but doing it in this kind of facetious way that, like, even though it's poppy, it's still so clockwork and organized and, you know, a little bit stale. It's this candy land. And I love really themey stuff. So for me, that movie is a dream come true. And it's also about human treatment. And I think that there's a great parallel between that and this music video, like in theme. And also, we obviously referenced it very heavily in the neighborhood.
So talk to me a little bit more about that. How do you think that the message of Edward Scissorhands and that Candyland suburbia translates to this sort of statement on Taylor Swift's part about being an ally and not hating, basically?
Well, it's a beautiful line to draw between them, because obviously the whole theme of Edward Scissorhands is casting somebody out for being different and actually really abusing people, and then a family trying to take in somebody who's different and make everybody see how beautiful somebody can be. I think it's a really, you know, it's a really important film and it had a big effect on me my whole life. But this obviously is a bigger statement where they've turned it on its head, and instead of the whole neighborhood being the people against who's different, the whole neighborhood is who's different. And, you know, the person who's different has multiplied greatly, and now the entire neighborhood is what's different. And I think that that's a really cool allegory for right now. I mean, not to say that everybody in this country feels that way, but to see somebody as huge as Taylor Swift making that statement and choosing to, you know, use her budget to make this video, to have this be like a huge statement right before her album comes out, is very meaningful. Whether you like her or not, whether you're a fan or not, like, this is a really huge chunk of her branding that she's dedicating to this message. And whoever still needs to hear it, it's really cool that they're going to hear it from somebody like her.
Yeah, I mean, she is getting, as I kind of referenced earlier, a little bit of pushback on this video from people who say that she's using the celebrities in the video to sort of further her own brand and not to make a real statement as an ally. What do you think about that, just out of curiosity, as someone with that behind the scenes perspective? And I just want to say, it is a little bit hard to imagine how Taylor Swift's brand could be bigger than it is already, but that's the part of it that kind of is a sticking point for me. But
sure. Well, there's not much I can say on behalf of the, you know, her brand or her people, obviously, though I think that there's more to come on this theme and people should just stay tuned to her. But what I think is that, I mean, to me, it doesn't really matter. I think I know that she's involving a lot of people so that no one's mad that she's making this statement. I think she's also included some links at the end and things that are actually productive, like getting in touch with your senators and people in your city to change things on the state level, which is obviously really important. You know, it's a call to action, which is never too late, in my opinion. And I think that even though there's a lot of hopelessness going on in our government, there's only, you know, so much that we have to work with. And one of those systems is voting and writing to our state representatives. And so she's calling for that to be done. I also think she was pretty integral at one point in calling for everyone to go out and vote in 2016, which I remember hearing, and I don't know that they can prove this, but that her influence really did get a lot more people, young people, out to vote, which, again, you can't quantify that. But I do think that, you know, I think she has an influence. And so I think at that point that was less politically charged and it was more, or, you know, on either side. But now she's really putting her foot in the ground and saying, like, it's not cool to feel this way anymore. And for me, just personally, even if it's a little late, I'd still rather see that happening than not. And I don't really care if it's just because she doesn't want to be uncool for not feeling that way, or, you know, for feeling, having anybody feel that way at this point. I think that, you know, there is no more room, there is no more time left to feel that way, no matter who you are. So for her to make that so public, with the amount of people that are listening to her, especially in certain parts of this country, still has a huge impact. It's still needed. And so I think, I don't care what her reasoning is behind it, that is still very useful. And I don't think it's worth bickering why she's doing it. I think we all just need to be glad that somebody of her level is willing to get her neck right out there and be like, I am with these people and I care about these things and it is not cool to feel this way anymore.
How do you feel about the aesthetics of the finished product?
I mean, we were really proud of it. The whole department was really blown away by it. I mean, we weren't sure how much post was going to be done over it when we heard that it was mostly going to be practical, you know, everything done in person. We obviously delivered everything that was asked and more. And so we hoped that that would be kind of the way it looked in the finished product. And it really did. It's really all there in person. We really did all of that. And we're so proud. I mean, it was such a pro team. Everyone was like just so professional and, you know, gave us every ounce of their mind and their physical strength and their attention to detail. Like, we were handing cake with our hands to all of those extras to throw cake at each other in the rain. We were, you know, running last minute to get more AstroTurf to make more areas green than was originally asked for. You know, just a million things that we made happen, I would say, not with ease, but definitely, you know, on deadline and professionally. We were safe and we were on time. And I think it really came out just like our designs. They're really very, very close to our treatment, and that's always a very satisfying feeling.
Is there a little detail in this video for You Need to Calm Down by Taylor Swift that you want to tell your friends and family back home to look out for? Something that just either makes you chuckle or that will feel like a kind of nod when they see it? Maybe they'll think of you.
I guess I would say, I mean, like, when you see the curtain behind all the drag queens, we were literally, like, the wind was blowing so hard that it created a sail. And so literally all of us, including me, who was not always set dressing on set, we were all behind it, holding it down and cutting slits in it so that it wouldn't blow away or topple the entire pipe and drape that was holding up the curtain over. So we were all holding it down and trying to staple gun it to the back of the stage and make sure that nobody was getting hurt or anything. So that was like a really fun moment where we were all involved. And yeah.
So maybe when they see that scene, when you see the curtain, you can know.
The pageant scene was all hands on deck. We were all back there doing stuff. So
Megan Mantilla, coordinator of the art department for Taylor Swift's new music video, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The video is for the song You Need to Calm Down. Megan is a graduate of KCAI, and she was super active in Kansas City's art scene, still is, even though she moved away. We knew her when, up next, the story of the guy who started the Grand Emporium, Roger Neighbor, stops by for a visit on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, for some of our listeners, Roger Neighbor needs no introduction. But for the rest of you, he is a Kansas City legend, best known for starting a blues venue in Midtown called the Grand Emporium. He now leads something called the Blues Cruise, which is basically as I understand it, the Grand Emporium on a cruise ship in the water. He does have other claims to fame, but we'll get to that. We're talking with Roger today because he's getting the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Kansas City, Kansas Street Blues Festival this weekend. Roger Naber, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Are you excited about this recognition?
Well, it's very nice that Dwayne Gilley and Kathy Ramirez are recognizing my 40 years in blues promotion this year, and appreciate it very much. So I'll be over there too.
What do you think you've done for the blues and for live music in general in Kansas City and beyond? Like, what, when you think about the impact you've had, what first comes to your mind?
Well, I think it wasn't just me alone, but starting my promotion out of my passion for the music and kept to my passion is what has made Kansas City, we put Kansas City on the map, blues music-wise, actually.
I had a feeling that you might not be totally forthcoming about what a big deal you are, so I brought in some reinforcements. Chuck Haddix of the Fish Fry is here. He runs the Mars Sound Archive at UMKC. And Chuck, how would you answer that question? Why is Roger Naber a big deal?
Well, Roger Naber has done more than anyone in Kansas City to bring the blues to the forefront and promote blues here in Kansas City. When I first met Roger, he's working for the post office.
That's right. I was a clerk.
And I was in Love Records over on Main Street, and our friend Bill Stretch Osment and was there with Roger, and they were going to go to Ruby's Soul Food. And from then, I was working in the record business, and then Roger began bringing in acts. His first booking was Lamont Cranston at Hot Rocks, which was the former Century Ballroom over on Main Street. And nobody was booking blues on this side of Kansas City. There were blues clubs like the Town Hall and
on Troost,
Blues Alley.
East of Troost.
There were a lot of blues clubs, but not on the west side of Kansas City. So he was quite surprised when so many people showed up for Lamont Cranston. And then he, of course, began booking at the Uptown Theater, taking leaps of faith, like bringing in Albert Collins at the Uptown Theater.
Why was that such a leap of faith? Help me understand that as someone who is not, like, inside this world of blues and blues promotion.
Well, I would say the leap of faith came when I actually had Luther Allison booked to play Hot Rocks, and then I was told by management that their Christmas party was 2 days prior to that, and they did not want to be open five nights in a row. And so I was pretty stunned that here was a club that I was bringing 300-plus people every time I did a show on an off night would want to turn down business. And I knew Luther was not strong enough to play the Uptown Theater, and so I booked Albert King to headline, as I had been to a few Albert King shows at the National Guard Armory. And that being a week before Christmas was a telltale that you can't really play with the big holidays on off nights. And so I lost my money that I'd saved during all my shows previously to that for the year. But I had my postal income to fall back on, so it was back to ground zero.
Yeah, and also Roger was key in establishing the Kansas City Blues Society, which promoted blues in Kansas City. He was president for 12 years. Of course, in the mid-80s, he opened the Grand Emporium, which became the most influential club in Kansas City, the most popular club, not only with blues artists, but booking great reggae acts, the Smashing Pumpkins, Harry Connick Jr., so many rising stars were there. And then there was a young woman named Danielle Nicole that did a matinee. So he was, and then, of course, with the legendary Blues Cruise, he went internationally.
Wait. We're not going to the Blues Cruise yet. I want to stick with the Grand Emporium for a while.
Okay.
So the Grand Emporium was on Main Street over just like at the very northern edge of Westport, the very northeastern edge of Westport, I should say. And it was in this sort of pocket where it had this giant marquee, but there was still something sort of like under the radar for something that has a giant marquee in front of it. It was in a very, it was not in a sort of flashy part of town, and it wasn't, I don't know, like it wasn't in a building that really like stood alone like so many theater type establishments do. Can you talk about the just where it was and what it meant to you to set up a blues club in this spot? And then we'll get to the fact that it was really not just a blues club. Not that there's anything wrong with just a blues club, but it did a lot more than that.
Right. Well, Gina, the Grand Emporium was a fairly insignificant looking building, like you said. There had been a hotel up on the second floor at one particular point in time, and it had been a speakeasy bar as well next to the former Toadman Cab Company. And then Antonio's Pizza came in next door, and it was a pizza by the slice. So there was some traffic that was generating, and Unicorn Theater moved in down the street and then moved next door to us when they expanded. And we expanded from a shotgun-style bar that held 200 people just shoulder to shoulder to about 350 shoulder to shoulder in 1987.
Why was this place a big deal when it first opened?
The first calendar that I put out, live music calendar, in July to August of 1985, we had John Lee Hooker on the calendar, Robert Cray on the calendar, R.L. Burnside on the calendar, and Roy Buchanan. So those were three established names. R.L. Burnside was not established yet at that time. But
Chuck, jump in here. I mean, why do you think that it was a big deal, especially if you look at the context of live music in Kansas City at that time more broadly?
It was an intimate club. You were right there. The dance floor was just about 5 feet away from the stage, just right at the stage. And so people, and you could move around. There was seating, but you could move around. But there was also, I think, a real sense of community.
So many, I put out a tweet asking about people's memories and what they think matters about this venue. And a lot of the stories sort of included getting to meet someone, getting to hang out with someone afterwards, like the performers. And that's what I think I've just heard my whole life. I never hung out with anyone when I went to the Grand Emporium, but I have heard from a lot of people. Like, that's, if you stick around, you're going to end up having a drink with whoever was on stage that night.
Right. Magic Slim was famous for that. Junior Wells was famous for that. But we didn't do just straight blues, and I knew I couldn't do blues six nights a week. I knew Kansas City didn't have the strong enough urban core community to support blues six nights a week. So that's why I went to a reggae night, world music night, and then I did the alternative punk stuff on Mondays with 25-cent beer offerings. And the Kansas City Art Institute kids and the UMKC kids started coming in on Monday nights. And
yeah, it felt like you were giving people who needed kind of like a musical home a place for their music to go and live for a night.
Right. We were the alternative to cover bands, and so we were the alternative to Westport.
There really wasn't anything like it at the time. If you want to relive the Grand Emporium, when the Emporium closed, Roger donated the posters and all of the press kits
and all the material
to UMKC. And you can go to, all you got to do is Google UMKC Grand Emporium, and you can see who played there.
Right. But where did those posters used to live? I think we need to describe the physical space a little bit more. These were plastering the inside of the venue, every flyer from every show.
Right. Well, we ran out of space, but we had, when you walked in the front door, I had three artists up there above where the doorman would stand, and that was our fifth anniversary. And that was a picture of Luther Allison, Sun Seals, and Albert Collins on the wall. Photo 8x10s, or actually larger than 8x10s. And then there were posters plastered, as you said, on all four sides. And we put some of the really important ones right by the stage so the performers coming in would see that Harry Connick Jr. had played there, or Dr. John had played there, or Wynton Marsalis had played there. So musicians knew they had to come with their game on.
Was there a piece of your own sentimentality, like you were living in your own scrapbook?
There was. I designed it actually initially after a little club that's in Lincoln, Nebraska called the Zoo Bar. And when I walked into the zoo before I owned the Grand Emporium, I said to myself, if I ever own a club, I want it to look like this. So I began putting the 8x10s above the bar and gluing them down. And before we really had live music going, full-time, Graham Nash walked in from Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and I was standing on the bar gluing 8x10s over it, and he said, well, I'm doing laundry up the street, and I saw Benny Spellman's picture in the window, and when I was in a band called The Hollies, we covered Lipstick Traces or Fortune Teller, so...
So you never know who those flyers are going to attract.
That's right.
Chuck, what are your memories of all of that? I mean, what do you think stands out as something really special now that we've been without it for a while? That changes what you think matters is not always what did.
Well, the convenience and the excitement of the club. I mean, what other club are you going to see Albert King with a 50-foot
guitar cord
playing in the middle of Main Street, or see Junior Wells? You get just the intimacy of that. You know, when there were posters all over the wall, but George Myers, Roger's partner, had stashed a bunch of posters behind the soundboard upstairs, and we were able to haul those out along with all the press kits. And we laid them out in the sound archive, and there was a big stack of them. I mean, just unbelievable collection. And the place smelled like cigarettes and beer for a couple of weeks. I mean, it was a classic juke joint.
You know, there was every Sunday, I think, the Millage Gilbert Happy Hour.
Oh, he was on Saturday.
Saturday, mm-hmm. Sorry, that makes more sense. Can you talk about that? What I loved about the Grand Emporium myself as someone who only went there for a pretty relatively short span of time just because of
my age.
But the way that the venue took on the personality of whatever the act was that you brought in. So like when you had a punk night, it felt like a punk venue. But then on Saturdays, it feels like a family reunion with Millage Gilbert and people in suits and nice hats.
Right. Yeah, we did the matinees starting, I think, with Little Hatch on Fridays, and then I added Millage on Saturday, and then started rotating when Little Hatch passed away. Then I brought in Brody Buster and Danielle Nicole. But those were regulars that came every Saturday afternoon for Millage Gilbert, and they all knew most of them all knew one another. And Harling's had Mama Ray up the street, so some people would go back and forth between the two venues.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of effort to recreate dive bars, you know, very popular with young people today. I'd have to say this was the ultimate dive bar. When you went in there during the day, the regulars would be in there drinking cheap beers.
Yeah, the old men across the street.
Yeah, the old guys across the street. What I loved about it is when I'd get off from the fish fry, I'd swing by there because it wasn't that far, and I could swing by and catch the last set. And nothing like walking up behind the Grand Emporium and hear Jimmy Johnson playing like Take Five. And you could music just emanated out into the street and really brightened up that corner of Main Street, which was kind of a ne'er-do-well area at that time.
Call 816-235-2888 to share your thoughts and join this conversation about what the Grand Emporium meant and maybe still means to Kansas City. 816-235-2888. Roger, how and why did you start booking shows to begin with?
My passion for blues music, and there was a shortage of it in Kansas City. When we wanted to see national touring acts, we had to drive to Lawrence, Kansas, or Columbia, Missouri, you know, to the major colleges in the area where there was club owners that would book these bands that were out on the road. And in 1974, I lived in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the University of Minnesota was very alive on the West Bank with blues clubs. And that's where I saw Lamont Cranston for the first time. I saw Albert Collins there. I saw Luther Allison, Bonnie Raitt, Buddy Guy, and Junior Wells. A lot of those, and Willie Dixon, I think. I saw him 7 times in that summer. And he's the most prolific blues songwriter of all time.
So you had become addicted.
Right.
Do you remember what made you fall in love with the blues as an art form to begin with? Was it this experience at the University of Minnesota?
No, it was prior to me leaving Kansas City. I was 18 or 19, and I went to see a Leon Russell show at Memorial Hall, and the opening act was Freddie King. Leon was promoting him. He had him on his label producing his records, and the energy that Freddie King had when he played on stage was just over the top for me. And I was a very novice to live music shows. You know, I didn't really grow up going to a lot of music as a teenager, but Freddie King was really the reason why I do what I do now.
You know, also, Roger, I remember you went to the town hall, too.
I did. That was in 74.
Yeah. But, you know,
what is that, going to the town hall? Forgive me. I don't know.
Well, the town hall was a venue on Truce, not far from here. And Willie Cyrus and Mrs. Garrett, who owned Garrett Records at 39th and Prospect, were booking bands into there, Vernon Garrett. And Roger, you worked with those guys, you know, Willie and Mrs. Garrett. They kind of helped you along in the early days.
Right.
And they were colorful figures, man.
Right. I worked with Willie Cyrus. Well, Willie was doing the Thanksgiving breakfast dances.
Yeah.
Which Kansas City still does. And Albert King told me that he started these in 1965 as far as for the blues community. And so in 1974, some friends of mine and I went for the first Thanksgiving breakfast dance that I went to for. And it was Little Milton and Freddie King. And so that's when I really started hanging out on the east side of town.
And that gave you a window into what was already going on in the blues here in Kansas City, just not
right.
In a part of town you had been frequenting.
Right.
Was that sort of an interesting piece of it, that there was the idea just of almost like a segregated audience kind of complicating what it means to produce a show or to promote a show?
Yeah, that always made me scratch my head in the blues community, where there was a black blues community and a white blues community, where in jazz it seemed like there was no black and white community. It seemed like they were mixing it up together.
Yeah, and I think Roger did a lot. You know, you really bridged that gap of bringing them together when you started the Blues Society. And, you know, also at that time you had Penny Lane Records, where I worked, and House Distributors, which distributed Alligator Records and Rounder Records and all these small blues labels. And then in 1980, when we started the Pitch, we had a means to promote them. And you would promote these shows in the Pitch, and Penny Lane would sponsor these along with Roger, too.
Right, and I would come in this studio and sit down with Lindsay Shannon occasionally. So
call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Roger Naber of the Grand Emporium, now the Blues Cruise, about his life and career as he gets ready to accept a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Kansas City, Kansas Street Blues Festival. We're also joined by Chuck Haddix, and we want your Grand Emporium memories. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with blues promoter Roger Naber and KCUR's own Chuck Haddix of the Fish Fry. We are reminiscing about the Grand Emporium, which Roger co-founded on Main Street. And Roger, can you tell me just a little bit more about the story of the founding of the Grand Emporium before we go on to our callers who want to talk about it?
Well, I was co-managing the Lone Star Rock Club in Westport and booking touring acts over there on off nights. And I was wanting to do it full time. And when I was doing a show years prior to that, maybe the year prior to that or 2 years prior to that, I was doing shows up at Parody Hall, and George Myers walked up and said, "I'm George Myers, and if you're interested in bringing John Lee Hooker to town, I'd really like to help." And so we started a relationship. He would join the Blues Society, and so I would see George at my shows.
So that's who the other co-founder was?
Right.
Let's talk to MK, who has some memories of the Grand Emporium to share. Hello.
Hello. It's very wonderful that you're being honored, Roger. So much joy and pleasure for so many people. A particular thing I want to point out that was meaningful to me is one of our great KC would die. You could just know that on Saturday afternoon, maybe Sunday, we'd be at the Emporium to do a musical honoring of that person's life. And those times were sacred and special and a hell of a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you, MK. The line there was a little bit rough, but what MK was talking about was that whenever a local musician died, that the Grand Emporium was the place everyone knew there would be a memorial, and that the memorials would honor the people, but they would also be fun parties.
Right. Well, you know, we honored our elders in the blues and jazz community here for sure, and anyone else who was really playing music full time. So, I mean, that's what we were. We were a music venue. There was no games to play. We did have a large TV screen, but it focused on the stage, and so there was no pinball machines, no pool tables. It was just all about the music.
And, you know, at that time, a lot of our elders, our valued elders, like Jay McShann, Step Buddy Anderson, Eddie Saunders were still alive. So when Eddie Cleanhead Vincent would come to town, he would play a four-night run at the Grand Emporium and on Thanksgiving, and all those guys would show up. It would be like old home week.
Right. I called Jay's house, and his wife, Mary Ann, said, well, Jay's not in town. He's out of town this week. And I said, well, just tell him Eddie Cleanhead Vincent was asking about him and is playing at the Grand Emporium. And 30 minutes later, Jay McShann walked through the door.
Let's talk to Jeff in Olathe. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Gina. I really enjoy your show. I know Roger and Chuck. I played in a band that played reggae and R&B back in the 80s, and Roger was always kind enough to tap us to be the backup band for whatever visiting blues legend. We backed up Rufus Thomas a couple times and Montella Bass, and I still play regularly with a loud rock and roll band here in town, and I've been over to Europe and traveled all over, and Roger had us back up Dr. John, and to this day, it's one of the highlights of my musical career. And so, Roger.
Yeah, Jeff.
I really appreciate that.
Well, Jeff, wait, hang on.
I still tell stories about that. Yeah.
I want to ask you, do you think that there are a lot of Kansas City musicians who got training from big deal people, in a sense, by getting to be a backup musician at the Grand Emporium? Being tapped, as you put it.
I'm sure there are. Roger was always very kind to us and, you know, saying Dr. John was originally going to just do a solo piano show, I think. And Roger said, no, get these guys because they're already playing some New Orleans stuff. And he said, well, I guess. And when we rehearsed by ourselves for, I think, two nights, and then Dr. John showed up at the afternoon soundcheck, and we ran through the whole set with him. As far as other musicians, I'm sure they did. If not from the stage, then, or if not from the audience, then sure, when they were on stage. I don't know. Roger, who else did you have backing up visiting people?
Well, it's good to talk to you, Jeff. Jeff Porter is who we're talking to. I did a few things with Big John Amaro, who was playing at Blues Alley when Roy Gaines came to town or whatever, you know. But most of the artists brought their own band, so I always wanted the bands to do their best show. Little Johnny Taylor came by himself as well. And I had the Soulard Band from St. Louis actually come in and back him up. But I preferred to have the artists have their own band because we were going to get their best show.
What is, you know, so there were the parties that were at the Grand Emporium, but Chuck was just telling me that one night after the fish fry, he went over and heard and met Stevie Ray Vaughan at your house at 4 a.m., something of this nature.
I don't know if it was 4 a.m., but it might have been about 2.
Chuck would not exaggerate, surely.
Yeah, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. We were waiting for Stevie Ray Vaughan and partying down.
Well, yeah, I had booked Stevie Ray at Harling's, a very small venue at Westport Road in Maine, on the 4th of July of 1981. And Stevie said, there's some guy that's kind of and being real sweet and trying to invite me to come to a party. And I don't know if he's gay or not. And so I'm staying over down at 33rd and Broadway. And so I said, well, I live two blocks away. Why don't you just come over to my house? So Stevie and his band came over to my house. And then the band left about 3 a.m. And Stevie stayed until sunrise.
That story took many unexpected turns.
Oh, it's always an adventure. And he paid Stevie Ray Vaughan $400 to play at the Falcon Club. It was known as the Falcon Club back then, if I remember right.
No, it was Harling's.
It was Harling's, yeah. And the Fabulous Thunderbirds had come through just a few weeks earlier, and they were playing a swamp rock thing, you know, swamp pop and blues. And Stevie Ray Vaughan, everybody was expecting that from Stevie Ray because nobody knew him, and he blew the doors off the place playing like Jimi Hendrix.
Let's talk to Pat. Pat is calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Hey, Roger. So I feel like I lived at Grand Emporium at my youth. The bartender was a gal named Shelley, who my good friend Greg ended up marrying. But we always felt like we went in there with $5, came out with 10, and drank for free all night. So thanks, Roger.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad you got your youthful chops there at the Grand Emporium.
And then in Los Lobos playing, that was a magical night. I remember it seemed like everybody in the music scene in Kansas City was there for Los Lobos. It's really fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the call, Pat. You know, what is it? So you went from running the Grand Emporium in Kansas City to doing the Blues Cruise. Can you tell the story of how that came about?
Well, I was also the festival organizer of talent here in Kansas City for the Kansas City Blues Festivals and then the Kansas City Blues and Jazz Festivals. And I'd been to the San Francisco Blues Festival, Long Beach, Chicago, New Orleans Jazz a lot. And I had heard about a blues cruise in 1991. And I thought, that's interesting. I've never been on a ship. And I think I'll get a ticket if I can. So I went. And out of the 1,700 folks on that old Norway ship, there was only about 70 blues music fans. It was a group. It wasn't a charter. But Jay McShann was on there from Kansas City doing solo piano, Buddy Guy, Albert Collins, Johnny Adams, Johnny Otis. And so I got out there on the ocean at night, and I thought, this is really, really an unusual kind of venue to have a blues festival at sea. However, this guy that was running it didn't enhance the sound systems of the old ship, and it was almost like walking into a Holiday Inn with a 1965 sound system. So I had offered him a little bit of encouragement to help me make his cruise better. And he
let me fix this, please.
Yeah. And he turned a deaf ear, and I came home. And in that particular era, in the late 80s and early 90s, I was taking a group of 100 folks to New Orleans Jazz Fest every year and with a travel agent, and I was just for a free trip for myself. And we were always filling her 100 passengers on flights. And I thought, well, I'll just maybe take 100 people on the next year's blues cruise. And I told my partner, George Myers, about it. And about a month later, he said, let's not take 100 people on somebody else's event where the sound is really terrible. Let's just do one ourselves and improve on it.
You know, I understand that. For a lot of people, the closing of the Grand Emporium felt like, you know, things will never be the same, and this is so hard to say goodbye. That's just people who, like, went there sometimes. How did that feel to you as the person who created it and put all those flyers up on the wall with your own hands?
Well, Gina, I mean, through the years, our attendance was dropping from people that lived in the immediate area, the 6411 zip code, which is where we were at one time. Our database was around 500 names, and it had dwindled to the low 300s or the high 200s. People had met at the Grand Emporium, and they'd gotten married, and they'd moved to the suburbs because they had kids and they wanted better schools. So, and then the Kansas City Police Department was doing DUI checkpoints over the hill, sitting in the blood bank at 41st in Maine, and so that was every time there was a spirit festival at Liberty Memorial or any kind of music festival in town, they would show up and try to arrest people coming south on Maine from.
So you didn't mind saying goodbye to some things, I guess.
Right. So
we got to jog out of here, but Chuck, any final words on this?
Well, you know, the Grand Emporium lives online. When Roger closed the Emporium, he donated all the posters and the photos. You can find him at, when you Google Labuddy Special Collections or UMKC Grand Emporium. You can look at all of them.
Okay, great. Well, you guys, thank you so much. Roger, P.S., happy birthday. You can be there when Roger accepts his Lifetime Achievement Award at the Kansas City, Kansas Street Blues Festival this weekend. It's this Saturday, starting at 1:45. There's more info on a Facebook page. And this show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.